The second case for oral argument this morning is the State versus Jeremiah. Is it Leah?
Leah.
Okay. Who is the appellant? And for the appellant, Mr. Leah, we have Mr. Boo Blowen. Is it
Megan?
Okay. Well, I was one for two. And for the State of South Dakota, we have Ms. Patricia Archer, an Assistant Attorney General from Pierre. With that, you may proceed, counsel, and you have 20 minutes. The lights are not working on the podium, but the digital clock is, and I'll give you a verbal at 2 minutes. So just ignore the lights. Sorry, we're trying to get them fixed. You may proceed, counsel.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bo Blewin, and I'm here today representing the appellant, Mr. Jeremiah Leah, on this appeal. Mr. Leah respectfully asks this court to reverse the judgment and sentence and to order a new trial on the charge of kidnapping in the second degree. The issues before this court are, first, whether the trial court erred in ruling that kidnapping in the second degree is a general rather than specific intent offense. Second, whether the trial court, due to that error, provided insufficient instructions to the jury when it declined Mr. Leah's proposed instructions on specific intent and voluntary intoxication. And third, whether the exclusion of those jury instructions on specific intent prejudiced Mr. Leah. With regard to number one, whether the trial court erred in ruling that kidnapping in the second degree is a general intent offense. Conclusions of law are reviewed by this court under a de novo standard. SDCL 2219(1), subsection 3, provides that any person who unlawfully holds or retains another person and with the purpose to inflict bodily injury on or to terrorize the victim or another is guilty of kidnapping in the second degree. This court in State v. Shelton recognized that specific intent crimes require that the offender have a specific design to cause a certain result, whereas general intent crimes require only that the offender engage in conduct that is prohibited by the statute, regardless of what the offender intends to accomplish. This court has defined specific intent as meaning some intent in addition to the intent to do the physical act. And the term designates a special mental element which is required above and beyond any requirement with respect to the actus reus of a crime. And the United States Supreme Court has noted that the term purpose corresponds with the concept of specific intent, and that for a person to cause a particular result, that person acts purposely if they consciously desire that result. Here, kidnapping in the second degree is a specific intent offense, because the language of the statute not only prohibits the act of holding unlawfully the victim, but it also requires the specific intent, the specific design, a purpose in the offender's mind to cause a certain result. And that result in this case is the infliction of bodily injury on or to terrorize the victim or another. In State v. Shelton, this court laid out a clear analysis of general versus specific intent by comparing two very similar statutes on sliming, which one of the statutes prohibited the sliming of an officer done by any person, the other by an inmate. Both statutes prohibited the act of sliming, but only one of the statutes contained language with the intent to assault. And this court observed that whereas the statute criminalizing the act of sliming was a general intent offense, the statute containing the language with the intent to assault was a specific intent offense because it indicated the legislature's intent for the statute to require a specific design to cause a certain result. And that same rationale applies in this case. Kidnapping in the second degree is a specific intent offense because it requires the specific purpose or conscious desire to cause bodily injury or to terrorize another. Second, because the trial court erred in ruling kidnapping in the second degree as a general intent offense, the jury did not receive sufficient instructions on the law applicable to this case. A trial court's decision to grant or deny a particular instruction is generally reviewed by this court under an abuse of discretion standard. However, a court has no discretion to provide incorrect or misleading instructions, and to do so prejudicially constitutes reversible error. Whether the jury instructions are sufficient, considered as a whole, is a question of law, reviewed de novo.
Was there prejudice here you can point to in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. And it's not something where I can give you a simple answer. It's looking at the record as a whole and the facts. In this case, there was not only evidence that Mr. Liao was extremely intoxicated, but evidence that raises significant doubt about what had even occurred on that day and whether Mr. Liao had any specific purpose in his mind at all. We know that shortly after the incident had occurred, Mr. Liao registered a PBT of 0.38, roughly five times the legal limit to drive, and a blood alcohol level that would have required him to be taken to a Vera Medical Emergency Department and to be medically cleared before being taken to the detox center, if that was where he was supposed to go. Officer DeShepherd described Mr. Liao as having poor mobility and extremely slurred speech that day. And Officer Jasso, who came into contact with Mr. Liao, had to help him sit, grab his arm, help him sit down on the curb while he mumbled to the officer words that he couldn't understand. And Officer Jasso also referred to Mr. Liao in his police car as a drunk fool and the walking dead. We know that on that sunny afternoon of October 25, 2014, that Mr. Liao first came into contact with the two witnesses, Gene Wolf and Mr. Nikolai Nedelko. Mr. Liao was walking down the sidewalk and walked up the driveway when he began to interact with them. Ms. Wolf described Mr. Liao as walking with his mouth hanging wide open and making deep and loud nonsensical sounds. Due to this bizarre behavior, Ms. Wolf said she admits that she told Ms. Colleen that don't touch Mr. Liao because he may be from Liberia and he may have the Ebola virus. Ms. Wolf referred to Mr. Liao at trial as the black man. We know that Mr. Liao walked up the driveway and that at that point Mr. Nedelko, who was a 75-year-old man with dementia symptoms, got out of his chair and began walking aggressively toward Mr. Liao, waving his arms and screaming. And Mr. Liao backed up three steps. Ms. Colleen heard the noise and she came outside and she placed herself between Mr. Nedelko and Mr. Liao. And at that point, Ms. Colleen says that Mr. Liao grabbed her hand with one of his hands and grabbed her upper back, neck, shoulder area, and that this hurt her. But we also know that when Ms. Colleen approached Mr. Liao, she pretended to know him, saying, "Wait a minute, I want to talk to you. It's okay, I know you from Morel's." Ms. Colleen said she said that to calm down her friends, but it turns out that her friends might not have been the only people who were fooled. In describing the event later to Officer Jasso, she says she told Mr. Liao to squeeze my hand. We are going walking. Mr. Liao held her hand, and Ms. Wolf went inside and grabbed the phone and brought it back out to Ms. Colleen, who called 911, Exhibit 1, the first call. And you don't hear any screaming. She says you can hear her talking to Mr. Liao in the background saying, you know, it's okay. I'm from Europe. You're from Africa. She tells dispatch to bring someone right away before he walked away. And at that point, Ms. Colleen testified that Mr. Liao walked with her, essentially pulled her down the street or down the sidewalk a little more than half a block. And from there, we know that at the corner, Ms. Colleen was released, and there was conflicting evidence of what happened at that point. Ms. Colleen testified that she had been pushed out into busy oncoming traffic, but that she was able to pivot and fall the opposite direction. That was the basis for the aggravated assault charge on which Mr. Liao was acquitted. But then Ms. Colleen followed Mr. Liao down the rest of the block, watched him go into a grocery store and come out, and then she walked into the grocery store, and she made the second 911 call. She didn't say that she was kidnapped or held against her will. She told dispatch that Mr. Liao, that she had called earlier and nobody had showed up, and that she had followed Mr. Liao. Ms. Wolf from the residence also called the police and said that Ms. Colleen had walked away with the phone, not that she had been dragged away. And a few minutes later, officers arrived and found Mr. Lea only two houses down from Ms. Colleen's residence, standing idly on the front, trying to interact with other neighbors who were sitting on their front porch. And so the facts in this case, even viewed in a light most favorable to the state, shed significant doubt on the portrayal of Mr. Lea as anything other than a very loud, disorderly, extremely drunk individual. And so the distinction between general and specific intent in this case was significant in determining whether he was guilty of this crime. And as a general intent offense, the jury was allowed to infer Mr. Lea's purpose merely from his actions and what resulted from those actions, in order to, with the jury finding that he may have intended what he did, his actions, and looked at what resulted. I think Ms. Colleen was scared of what happened. But I also think there was a very big lack of communication and things were lost in translation. The instruction on specific intent as an element was necessary to provide the proper mens rea required to convict Mr. Lea. And it allowed the jury to apply, it would have allowed the jury to apply the evidence that specific intent required.
But didn't the jury get to do that? Because, I mean, explain to me, what's the difference between between the defendant's purpose to terrorize and the defendant's intent to terrorize? I don't see a meaningful distinction.
I agree that the jury was instructed on what the elements were. That was laid out, that's what they had to find. However, there was never an instruction on how the jury was to get to that purpose. They were allowed to infer, essentially, approach the case and determine what his purpose was based upon what the actions were. And this concept of specific intent is difficult for everyone.
But how would that be? How would the jury look at that differently? I mean, they were told that the state had to prove he did it with the purpose to terrorize her. How would the lay people on a jury make their decision any differently if the judge had used the word intent instead of the word purpose?
Well, because if they were instructed, the trial court declined Mr. Lea's proposed pattern instruction on specific intent in 112.2, and that instruction would have informed the jury that in order to find him guilty, there must have existed in the mind of Mr. Lea the specific intent to inflict injury on or to terrorize Ms. Kling or another. And if that specific intent did not exist, the crime had not been committed. And so the difference is, whereas with a general intent offense, a jury could infer the intent simply from the actions and looking at the results, but if they were given this specific intent instruction, they would have known that that's not enough, that they had to specifically find that when Mr. Lea held her hand and took her down the block, that he specifically had it in his mind that he wanted to hurt her or to terrorize her. And that was the issue in this case. And that makes it even more essential that this instruction was given. And even in the comments to South Dakota Pattern Jury Instruction 112.2, it says, in a case of a crime involving specific intent, the court on its own motion must give an appropriate instruction on specific intent required as an element. And I realize that's not binding, but those committees are made up of well-respected lawyers and judges, and it's well acknowledged that specific intent is a difficult concept for people to understand. And it was necessary to show the jury that that special mental element above and beyond the intentional act of doing the act itself was required. And the jury instructions were inadequate in that regard in this case.
Mr. Blunt, how did the court's instruction... I think the court changed the instruction on voluntary intoxication, did it not? How did that affect this? How did that interact with the specific intent requirement?
Well, and that's a While the failure to provide the pattern instruction on specific intent as an element is the chief error in this case, the trial court did also err with regard to the voluntary intoxication instruction.
Well, aren't they interrelated?
They are interrelated. What I mean to say is, so the court only provided the first two sentences or paragraphs and left out the rest of the pattern instruction, which actually does explain to the jury sort of how to apply the defense of voluntary intoxication to specific intent and to decide whether that specific intent is negated from the voluntary intoxication. And so because the trial court ruled that this was a general intent offense, they left off the second half of the pattern instruction. And I would note that Ms. Archer is correct that the proposed instruction number 3 consisted of a combination of the language from the two alternate pattern instructions. The last sentence was taken from the alternate pattern instruction, but all this language was from the pattern. And so this language, which was excluded, was important because it did provide the jury with the framework to look at and decide whether, you know, how did this defense of voluntary intoxication apply to specific intent. And so I think considering the jury instructions as a whole, the jury was inadequately informed due to the lack of any instructions on specific intent whatsoever.
So, counsel, when were you, you were trial counsel?
I was not.
Do you recall from your review of the record when trial counsel was notified that the specific intent and pattern voluntary intoxication instructions would not be given?
There were discussions early on prior to voir dire.
And it seems, though, there was a discussion, to follow up on what Justice Inner said, about purpose in voir dire, and then throughout the trial, in opening and in closing. And so it almost seems as though the trial court expanded the evidence to allow evidence of specific intent, but then didn't give the instructions that were proffered by Mr. Leah's defense counsel.
Well, prior to voir dire, the judge did provide the basic instructions that he knew that he was going to give regarding the elements of the offense. And so counsel was provided those, and they were able to go off of those. But they weren't able to talk specifically about specific intent in voir dire or an opening or closing. But you are correct that defense counsel was able to argue that Mr. Leah had no purpose at all. And so there was an argument back and forth, what was the purpose. But I guess I would say that arguments of counsel in closing argument doesn't carry the same weight as an instruction that these jurors are sworn to follow, and that there was still that lack of an instruction explaining to them exactly how they were supposed to look at those elements and exactly how they were to apply them. And it's clear the jury did struggle. There wasn't consensus over this charge. They did write a note and said, we have no consensus, but they were sent back to deliberate further. And eventually they found Mr. Leon not guilty of aggravated assault, guilty of the second-degree kidnapping. So despite counsel being able to argue that Mr. Leah had no purpose, without the jury instructions, I believe it was still prejudicial error in this case. So the trial court erred in ruling that kidnapping the second degree is a general intent crime. This was a very close case. The facts lined up in such a way that this instruction was extremely important to make sure that the jurors understood what they needed to find. Mr. Leah was at a blood alcohol level that for most people would be lethal, but for a person with extreme alcoholism. There was testimony that a person at this level can experience a blackout, still talk and carry on, but not remember anything the next day. Mr. Leah has a long history of trespassing. No prior felonies whatsoever. Mr. Leah sat in the back of the patrol car, dumbfounded that he was being accused of kidnapping. And so this charge of the charge is a specific intent crime because it requires the jury to find that he had that specific design to cause this result. And the trial court erred in declining to provide Mr. Leah's proposed instructions. It had the effect of lowering the state's burden to prove every element beyond a reasonable doubt. And so Mr. Leah respectfully asks this court to reverse the judgment and sentence and order a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Archer, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. A jury of 12 Minnehaha County citizens found beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant held or retained Angela Kalin with the purpose to inflict bodily injury or to terrorize her or another. A defendant claims that the trial court erred in not giving the defendant's proposed instruction on specific intent and voluntary intoxication. But there's no prejudicial error here because the jury instructions that the court did give as a whole adequately and correctly informed the jury, and the defendant has failed to prove that the jury's verdict would have been any different with regard to this kidnapping charge had his instructions been given.
How do you ever prove that, though? I mean,
pardon?
How do you ever prove that, you know?
Well,
you state it that way, it's almost impossible to prove that.
And that's the standard that this court has laid out. But the state's position is that there is no prejudice here. There's no prejudicial error here. Counsel's gone through his version of the facts as defense sees them. However, the jury considered all of those facts, considered all of the evidence, and ultimately found him, the defendant, guilty. And I think that the evidence that was provided at trial does bear that out. Sufficiency of the evidence is not an issue here. And so we're left with respecting the jury's verdict in that regard.
Is there any question that this is a specific intent crime? Are you conceding that?
Your Honor, I think
you did in the brief, but I'm just want it clear.
Given the status of this court's case law, I think a reasonable interpretation of this case law is that it is. But here the outcome would be no different, and that is because the totality of the instructions that were given, as well as defendant's ability to have presented his theory of the defense through his evidence and his argument.
Well, but the instruction on intoxication goes specifically to specific intent crimes, and if you can't adequately deal with that in this case.
You're right, Your Honor. General intent crimes, a defendant is not entitled to get a voluntary intoxication instruction. So those would normally only be given in a specific intent case. And here, the beauty of this is that the trial court gave a voluntary instruction.
Was this language given? If you find the defendant at the time of the alleged offense was so intoxicated as to have no volition and had lost control of his will and was incapable of forming a purpose or intent, then specific intent is lacking, and you must return a verdict of not guilty.
No, Your Honor. That language, which is taken from one of the alternative patterns, was not given. Nor was the language from the first alternative intoxication pattern instruction given that dealt with, the element of the offense and what the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And there was no reference to specific intent. But the state's position is that that's not fatal. The trial court did give a voluntary intoxication instruction. The court told counsel before trial even started, you know, when there's a lot of conversations about what instructions were going to be given here. And before voir dire, the trial court said, you know, I'm going to be giving a voluntary intoxication instruction. He based it off of the statute, 2255, and the instruction that he did give was almost verbatim the language of that statute. I'll read off in pertinent part to you. And this is at instruction number 28. It's at appendix page 11 of my brief. There's evidence in this case that the defendant may have been intoxicated at the time of the alleged commission of this offense. And then going on, you may consider the fact, if it is a fact, that the accused was intoxicated at the time of the alleged offense in determining the purpose, motive, or intent with which the act was committed, if the act was committed by the defendant. That's verbatim from the statute. It's hard to say that a trial court instruction that mirrors a statute is insufficient or not adequate under the law. And this kind of instruction was actually approved in the State v. Plenty Horse case back, the first Plenty Horse case in 71, where even with, though a pattern was available, the court had given the verbatim of the statute. So it's not error to have given what the statute says. The other reason it was not error to have given this particular instruction was that, you know, a trial judge is not mandated to give a pattern. This court certainly has recognized, yes, patterns are good. You know, they've been researched and thought out. But it's not mandated either by statute or by this court's case law. In fact, the court has already acknowledged that they're not mandated. And so in here, the court took basically the first two paragraphs of the pattern. The only party left out was the specific intent portion. And the reason for that, and the court did determine prior to trial that he believed this was a general intent crime. He based that in part because of the lack of any definitive statement by this court that it was specific. And so the state's position is that there is no prejudicial error here, because if you look at all the instructions that were given, they adequately and correctly stated the law. Counsel has not cited anything that says that the instructions that the court gave were erroneous. I think the defendant's argument is that it just didn't go far enough. And, you know, we talk about specific intent versus general intent. Really, that's kind of a legal exercise that lawyers and judges do in chambers before the trial starts. And it's important, you know, because it obviously dictates, what has to be proved at trial, what kind of instructions have to be given, and perhaps even what kind of defense might be available. But ultimately, and this court has recognized, what's most important is what did the jury hear in the courtroom from the trial judge as far as the instructions go. And so, you know, we could focus on, you know, what it is, but the more important question is, what did the jury hear? And so I'd like to talk a little bit about what the jury was instructed in this case. Instruction 19, which is attached in Appendix 8 of my brief. The elements of the crime of kidnapping in the second degree, each of which the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt, are, I'm going ahead, the defendant did unlawfully hold or retain Angela Killeen. The defendant's purpose was to inflict bodily injury on or to terrorize Angela Killeen or another. And along with that, instruction number 36, at appendix page 12 of my brief, and pertinent part, if any member of the jury has any reasonable doubt that the defendant committed the offense charged in the indictment, or any reasonable doubt upon any element necessary to constitute the offense charged, then it is the juror's duty to find the defendant not guilty. Let's compare this to defendant's proposed number 2. In the crime of kidnapping in the second degree, there must exist in the mind of the perpetrator the specific intent to inflict bodily injury or to terrorize Angela Killeen or another. If specific intent did not exist, this crime has not been committed. That is essentially what 19 and 36 have already been told to the jury. Here's the elements of the crime. Here's what the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And if you don't find that the state has done that, then you find the defendant not guilty. So in this instance, and perhaps it's because of the unique nature of the kidnapping elements, the fact that it has the purpose element. But in this case, the jury was instructed that they had to find the defendant had that purpose. And they had to find it beyond a reasonable doubt, or they should acquit. So this is not a situation where the lack of a specific intent instruction is fatal. And in fact, this court has held in the past that even when it was necessary to have given one, it's an explicit instruction on specific intent the lack of it is not fatal as if the other instructions as a whole adequately cover the principle. That was recognized in 1996 in State v. Hart, H-A-R-T, 544, Northwest 2nd, 206. And so again, you know, the question is what was given, and the state's position is that when looked at as a whole, the concept of defendant's purpose in committing this crime was covered. And that ties into the intoxication instruction then, because again, the only portion of the intoxication instruction that the trial court omitted was this concept about specific intent. And so if that's already covered by other instructions, then the entirety of the instructions was also appropriate. Finally, I'd like to talk about the lack of prejudice in this case. And Justice Zinder, you commented on, you know, how do we ever know for sure? And all I can say is, you know, we look at the jury's verdict as a starting point. And the jury found beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant committed the crime of second-degree kidnapping. Now, counsel suggested that maybe they had some discussion or some difficulty in reaching that. And, of course, we never know what's going on in that room. But they did send a note out, but it was not... I think it's fair to infer that the question they had didn't have to do at all with the purpose issue, because right after that, they came back. They acquitted on first-degree kidnapping and then also on the aggravated assault, but they convicted on the second-degree kidnapping. So, in essence, the only difference between those is whether or not he carried her away a substantial distance. So the question of purpose, I don't believe, was at issue. But I think it's fair to say that the defendant hasn't shown that the jury probably would have returned a different verdict if only his proposed instructions had been given. The jury heard the state's evidence, and you know, counsel version, I have to say, you know, made it sound almost like the defendant was on an afternoon stroll with this victim, and it was anything but. The evidence showed that the defendant showed up out of nowhere, and you know, entered this woman's property. These people are just out there enjoying the afternoon on a patio, and making angry noises and angry gestures. I think the evidence also showed that, you know, English is not his first language, so we don't know what he was saying. But they're just sitting there. They don't know this defendant. This is this large man. And all of a sudden, you know, when Angela comes out, he grabs her, hauls her down the hot sidewalk, and pushes her towards oncoming traffic on Cliff Avenue. Now, it turns out, fortuitously, that she was able to avoid being thrown in the front of oncoming traffic, but she was scared, and that came out during her phone call that she ended up making from the store. Her friend was scared. Everyone was scared, and so the jury heard that. They also heard the defendant's evidence. They heard his evidence about the BAC levels and his level of intoxication, and they saw the videotape. They saw or heard the testimony of the officers, but they also heard his expert. And his expert from the detoxification center was talking about how depending, you know, she's seen a lot of individuals come through there. And she said, yeah, you know, people with 3 5s or 4 0s can function, and they can function with a purpose. It depends on their tolerance level. It depends on the level of their history of drinking. So she could not testify specifically as to this particular defendant because she did not interview him, I don't believe. But the jury heard that. The jury also heard the defendant's closing argument. And that entire argument was all about whether the defendant had the purpose to have committed this crime. So the jury weighed all of that. They found that the defendant did indeed commit the crime of kidnapping. It's the state's position that there's no prejudice here by the fact that these particular instructions that the defendant was seeking weren't given, because of the totality of the instructions that were given covered it. And the defendant was still able to present his theory of defense in all respects through evidence and through argument. We would ask, Your Honors, that this conviction be affirmed And if there's no questions, I will sit down.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Archer.
Thank you.
Mr. Bluen, you have 10 minutes, sir.
May it please the court. Council argues that there was a failure to show any prejudice in this case. And I agree that it would be difficult to ever show that prejudice existed. And we're required to look at the record. That's the only way to know, is to look at the facts of the case and what was testified to. And this case is a test case for why an instruction on specific intent must be given. If there was ever a case where specific intent must be given, it's this case. Ms. Archer says that there was a voluntary instruction given and there was discussion about it being given, but counsel for the defense never agreed to that instruction, and they did offer a pattern instruction on voluntary intoxication, which included the specific intent language.
What was the circuit court's comment, if any, in rejecting that instruction?
Well, when it rejected both the voluntary intoxication instruction as proposed and the specific intent, the court did acknowledge that the question wasn't as clear as he would like, but that he believed it to be a general intent offense. And the comments to the voluntary intoxication pattern instruction does indicate that if the crime does not involve a specific intent, then the court may give the first two sentences. And I think that's what the judge did in this case. He followed the comments, and the comments do also state that the full pattern should be given if it is a specific intent offense. Counsel also points to State v. Plenty Horse in those cases in the early 1980s in which it was found reversible error not to give the voluntary intoxication instruction. And I would point out that the instruction was revised in 1997. It used to be where those first two sentences was all that there was. And so that's why it's difficult to apply those older cases to the present, because in 1997, the additional language specifically requiring the language with specific intent was added. And I have not found any cases on point with the full pattern in the last 20 years. Counsel also states that we have not provided any authority to show that the jury was ever given any erroneous instructions. However, when we're dealing with the concept of specific intent, I'd submit that providing insufficient instruction is misinforming the jury because they're not provided with that legal concept.
Ms. Archer pointed out that the instruction on voluntary intoxication that was given, if not mirrored the statute, was very close to the statute. Why would that not be sufficient if it's following the statute?
Well, and I think the law on general and specific intent has developed over the years, and that statute was in place back when these other cases were decided, which required the instruction on voluntary intoxication, and that did mirror the statute, and that statute does say that. She is correct. But again, since 1997, the full pattern has included that specific intent language, and even the comments now say if it's a general intent offense, then just the first two paragraphs, which does mirror the statute in that case. However, the lack of that language, in addition to providing the pattern instruction on specific intent for a specific intent crime, considered as a whole, that was prejudicial to Mr. Liao, because that was the crux of this whole case. I would also note, this cases similar to State v. Jones, where this court found that the trial court had failed to instruct the jury on a knowing element in a rape third case. The statute didn't have the knowing element specifically in the statute, but this court read the knowing element into that crime and said that that was required to be instructed in order for the jury to be properly instructed. In this case, we don't. In Jones, we went from no mental mens rea to general intent. In this case, we go from general to specific, and no instruction was given on specific intent. And in that way, it is like State v. Jones. In some of the other cases that counsel proposes as showing that, you know, this court has found that where instructions are given which substantially, even if implicitly, instruct the jury, those were such as State v. Walton, State v. Birdsheed, State v. Wallach. Those were all cases in which the court actually did provide instructions on self-defense and justifiable homicide, and that the court just didn't adopt the exact instructions that were proposed by the defendant. And in that case, for example, State v. Clott, the defendant proposed an extra sentence, and the court found, well, the trial court gave almost the entire instruction, word for word, left out a sentence that really didn't bring anything to the table, didn't describe anything, and so that was not found to be prejudicial. Here, we have no instructions on specific intent, and that did misinform the jury because it allowed them to interpret and to infer what Mr. Liaw's purpose was simply through his actions and what resulted from those actions. But we know that specific intent requires more. It requires that special mental element above and beyond the intent to do the act. And that was missing in this case, and that prejudiced Mr. Liaw. It lowered the burden of the state to prove every element beyond a reasonable doubt. And if that instruction would have been given, the result probably would have been different. So Mr. Liaw respectfully asks this court to reverse the judgment and sentence and order a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Court will be in recess.